Okay, welcome to another episode of the Live Your Full Potential podcast. I'm joined by my co-host, our CEO, founder, and master coach, JP De Villiers, and our special guest today, who is Dr. Brian Hemmings, a sport and performance psychologist who for over 30 years has been working executive coaching, elite level sport, education, mentoring, and academic research. Been working with a real wide range population from chief executives right the way through to entrepreneurs, gold medalists in boxing, winners in golf, Grand Prix, Formula One winners, and performance directors. We're going to dig in and explore some of the inner game of performance in today's conversation. Dr. Brian Hemmings, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, JP, for the invitation to join you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Brilliant to have you here. Yeah, absolutely. So, Brian, maybe just for the benefit of the audience and the summary that I just did of your bio there, probably does it a huge disservice in terms of the work you've done. Do you mind just sharing a little bit more that you can add on to that so we've got some more context?
Crikey, well... Probably started in quite humble beginnings, really. I'd left school at 16, was quite disaffected with school, then went, did some quite sort of fairly average jobs, really. My older brothers were quite high achievers, really, academically. And then I went to Australia for a couple of years playing football. I was quite a gifted footballer. Wouldn't have been a professional, but I was pretty good. And then I came back and sort of searching for things to do in the UK, and there were a lot of sport degrees just starting out in the late 80s. And I went off and down to the south coast in the UK to Chichester, did an undergraduate degree and did pretty well. And then they asked me to stay and do a PhD. So I did that. And that's when I sort of really started specialising in sports psychology and was working with elite boxers, Olympic boxers. I felt really out of my depth at the time because I kind of just had an undergraduate degree. But I think some life experience also helped me at that point. And I was one of eight children. So I guess I kind of knew some rough and tumble and a bit about negotiating and sharing or not sharing. But no, I think that generally helped me in terms of interpersonal skills. And I guess what you learn over the years and the research in high performance, certainly in sport, would suggest in psychology that it isn't really just interventions and techniques which promote effectiveness. There's quite a deal of evidence now that it's the professional relationship which has a big impact on performance outcomes in terms of in terms of the psychology of performance when you're working with athletes and coaches and so on. And I felt without wishing to sound arrogant at all, I felt that came kind of quite naturally to me in terms of getting on with people. I'd worked, in my career, I'd worked with people from all sorts of walks of life, different cultures, and I felt pretty able to build rapport with people quite quickly, and that helped then in terms of trying to help them better understand themselves and the psychology of their own performance. Because there's obviously general principles around the psychology of performance, but it's also, and this will sound very obvious, but it's very individual, and you really got to get to know that person. And maybe what are the barriers to their own performance or their own potential? So kind of as I usually do, going a little bit off of tangent, because you said, tell me a little bit more about yourself. I could talk about, the various sports in a bit more depth. We might get into some of that. But, essentially it's 30 odd years working in a variety of performance environments with different sports and in business, if people want to work with me, I just kind of try and sit down with them, work out how I might help them if I can, and then we usually find out a way that improves what they do.
Amazing. JP?
Brian, thank you for sharing. I would love to go with the first question because it's quite a big question. And I'm not even confident that you've been asked this question before. So I hope I'm going to ask it in the right way. You just finished on talking about what limits performance or high performance. And as you can probably see, for those that are listening to the audio, you can't, but I'm covered in tattoos. And one of the first tattoos I ever had was do what you love and love what you do. In 30 years of doing what you've been doing, what have you seen in your own career in terms of people trying to excel at things that clearly they're just not meant to excel at? And maybe it's come from an external influence and you can just see they lack passion for what they do. I know you work very much at the top end of the spectrum with world champions and winners, etc. But I would love to, for the audience, have you share your thoughts on being passionate about what you do and not just working on increasing your skills and knowledge.
Okay, so it's okay. If I go off at a tangent, JP, pull me back. Feel welcome to pull me back.
this is your time. Go for it.
What came to mind is you said passion. I think of enthusiasm. There was a football commentator, soccer commentator. Some people might know it as soccer, who died in the UK earlier this year. John Motson, Matt, you'd probably Motty. There was a great program on him, and it featured his wife and his son and him. This was before he died, but he was talking about his career, the progression in his career, and he talked about the professionalism in which he approached football commentating and the meticulous detail, attention to detail in preparing for what he did, to be excellent at what he did. And he said something like, there was an old typewriter, and he said, there's so many people who write to him that say, I want to get into broadcast journalism, or I want to get in commentating, how do I do it? And he had this old typewriter, and apparently he responded to each person with a hand, with a typed letter about, and he said, the one thing I can't give you or can't give you advice on is opportunity and enthusiasm.
Wow.
And I think you term the term passion, and I would say enthusiasm. So lots of people come to me, want to do what I've done or similar things in my career. And I say, look, I can advise you about which professional bodies to try and approach, which qualifications you might seek, what are good courses, what are some ways of picking up clients. But what I can't advise you on is that thing is about your what enthusiasm you take to what you do. And that's not suggesting that enthusiasm is everything, because, you know, it's a mix of those things. It's a mix of, perhaps in sport, it's a mix of technical skills, physical attributes. And for all the time I've worked, success is also, to some degree, down to timing and luck. You know, when you're competing against other people, sometimes it's things that are outside of your control which determine whether you medal, how successful you are. So, JP, bring me back and tell me, have I answered you, or would you ask for more specificity?
No, I think that was a perfect answer. And we rarely use the KISS model in our business, keep it super simple rather than keep it super simple, stupid. And I love what you just shared. I can't give you advice on enthusiasm. You know, you can go and do all the training in the world, read all the books, but it's always going to come down to, as in one of the ingredients necessary for high performance is, and sustained high performance is, are you enthused? Do you actually have the passion and the energy to do it? So you're really, really
good. And also, as in life, sport is about adversity, I think, as well. And my own career, I'm sure your own career as well, is that there's been periods where things aren't going your way, and often through no fault of your own. Maybe decisions go against you, or you don't get the role that you feel you deserved. And it's that willingness to keep going sometimes when things are stacked against you. And I think, again, in high performance, the ones that do it year on year, and they learn ways of winning even when they're not performing well, they increasingly kind of get to know their own method is what works for them, and really they stick to that process regardless of outcome. Even though, you know, you've got people writing about you maybe in the press that are saying you've got it all wrong and there's opinions of you, is that, well, this is my method, this is the only thing I can control, and I've got to stick to that. That's not to say that people don't tinker with how they go about and perhaps learning new things. But I find the best, they sort of get past searching for this elusive ingredient that's always going to bring them success. They recognize that, you know, some things just aren't, some days it's not going to be my day. And I think that's why I've been pretty successful. What I did is I recognized that with people and just discussed that I'm not offering some sort of utopia or there's going to be a eureka moment where everything becomes simple. It's more of how can I do this more consistently well with the attributes and the knowledge I've got, and to be proud of that, you know, to be proud of this is what I've got, and if I stick to that, it's likely to bring success more often than not. Rather than, I think sometimes with sports psychology, you see it kind of becomes a bit guru-ish and over-promising results. And I think if you get with real people who are really, really good at what they do, they see through that.
Fantastic answer. Thank you so much. I could easily do this for hours. Thank you very much. When it comes to, I think it's self-determination theory talks about performance accomplishments. And something we speak of often is consistency and discipline and how ticking off boxes essentially every day boost your self-confidence. But also the opposite is true. I've not heard a psychologist talk about it, but I mean, based on the obvious, if you're ticking off the boxes, you're going to boost your self-confidence. Yeah. But if you're not a person of your word and you don't accomplish the goals that you set out for yourself, you're actually, your self-confidence is going to go down. I just love your thoughts on that, just to kind of get some evidence to support what we do.
Yeah, I think you're talking, one is you're talking about goals and adherence to goals my experience over the years is you'll meet people who say, I don't set goals because, you know, and what you find is they're very good at setting sort of outcome based goals. And they really don't understand the subtleties of goals, about this, again, coming back to process and what's in your control and what's out of your control, is that essentially, and I'm talking about sport here, is that winning is out of your control. So they're very, sometimes very wanting to set outcome goals, but none of the kind of the underpinning performance and process goals which support that. And I think that the best ones as well in terms of adherence is, we talk sometimes, I think at that level, JP, you're talking about very, very simple things, but basic things that people do day in, day out. And although, and I think that's where that some people get bored and search for, there must be something new that I've got to do. I've got to something, actually it isn't. Most of my performance, I find over the years, is actually just willingness to do those same things day in, day out, where other people fall off and don't adhere because they want to find something, they want to find something new. Actually, we did some research many years ago, I think, in golf with a South African company. It was Titleist, you know, the equipment suppliers. And there was a South African company. We looked into sort of the attributes of some of the best English golfers over a certain period. And we had some major winners in the sample. We had some Ryder Cup players, we had some professional tournament winners, and then some of the England squad and so on. And they benchmarked they did this process of benchmarking, a kind of, what are the characteristics of the behaviours and attitudes of these, of this sample. It wouldn't have been published in a scientific journal, but it was scientific enough for our purpose, because what the head coach wanted to know was, you know, what are the attitudes and disciplines we're trying to build here in terms of being golf specific? And it, not surprisingly, it showed us that each of these players was individually different. They had strengths, they had limitations, but they were all consistent in five areas. One of them, which was discipline, which I say, well, it's not that surprising that you'd need a high amount of self-discipline. And you were talking about goals and being disciplined to stick to quite simple things, adhere to things that others wouldn't do. But the interesting part was that they're also very, very good at taking discipline from others. And typically those others would be the coaches or support staff around them. So I guess it's a truism, isn't it, that people say, you know, no one succeeds on their own. And that was the idea that, you know, in high performance, as in business as well, the people who are really successful have people around them that they also take discipline from. Sometimes as a leader, that's hard because you're the one who has to make the decisions and everyone looks to you. But the best leaders, in my experience, have also got a support network around them that help them keep focused on the goals that you perhaps are referring to. You said about the kiss. The other thing was simplicity. And, you know, again, golf, not untypical of high performance sport, is when you really get involved in any high performance in any area, the intricacies of it is astounding. And golf is very technical. It's, you know, it's a lot of data collection now in terms of what the ball, the equipment, you know, biomechanics. And what we found is those ones that the people also the very best are very, very good at keeping things very simple too. So to them, yes, you've got all this data, you've got all this equipment, but actually the essence of it is it's still a game. It's still a game to be played. And so, again, I think if you extrapolate that to other fields, other sports, is that the very best will still treat this, you know, that I've got all this information available to me, but actually it's just these two or three things that are actually key in terms of my success. I don't complicate it any more than I need to. I could go on. You're testing my memory about
right,
the
other, no, it's brilliant, other, right? And we use Ben Hunt Davis's analogy of will it make the boat go faster? And,
yes.
And I often I try and share my golf analogies around the simplicity of things because there is a lot of information to share.
Can I just share something off the back of that, and then I'll hand over to you?
Yeah,
that
was absolutely such a
brilliant answer, and I'm sure Matt saw. Yesterday in our community, we have a mastermind called Live 100, and in the community there was this thread starting of let's do, because they're very much looking for mental high performance, physical high performance, happiness, and they said, oh, let's do a 12-week body transformation. And I was out running a marathon yesterday for my own challenge, and I needed to chime in, and I guess this is when that discipline from others comes in. Dr. Hemmings and Matt, what evidence we're building here for our community. This is amazing. And I just shared a video in our group and I said, guys, this is amazing that you want to do a 12-week body transformation. It's really good to get focused for immersion, but it does not beat the little things that you do every day. Because if you can't get 10 little things on a daily basis nailed every day, you can have the best 12-week transformation and then you'll just fall back to where the temperature gauge was set to in the first place. And it's always going to go back down to that base. So yeah, just really amazing share, connect with it really well. Over to Matt Grady.
Again, not suggesting those things you said about the dial goes back. I think just human behavior tends to be that, especially now, is that people, if they can, will look for the easiest option. Some of those things, unless they're really habitual, they're going to be tough. They're going to be tough to sustain. But I guess it's if you know your role and you know what you aspire to, you will always find time to do those basic things where others will fall away.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the work we do as well, Brian, is connecting the activities to the values that these people have and the things that they hold the most in high regard, and the goals that they aspire to, so we can ingrain some better habits. And relating to the golf thing there, being willing to do the mundane things that most people are not willing to do on a daily basis, because it's not normal, but the results are.
Yeah. And I think that, again, just to do that is that some people feel that, well, there must be an easier way, or surely I don't have to keep doing this.
Yeah.
But the smart ones are ones who realise that, well, no, that's a prerequisite. Look, there's lots of things in my job, for example, without boring you senseless, there's lots of things in my job I'd much rather not do. The things that are dull and repetitive, but I'll just get on and I recently I was doing some workshops for like trainees and I think sometimes I talk about things and I think surely this is so simple, they must know this, and I sort of say about some of the skills they require. And if you put them out to poll about what the things they want to learn, they want to learn about the things that seem exciting. But the very things that I think are about professionalism and doing things really well and reliably, the things that people really count on, they don't see the importance of that. It's kind of I've got to know the next theory.
Yeah.
and actually, that really isn't that important. Yes, it's good to know it, but it's not going to be critical to your. It's not going to be critical to your success.
Yeah, just get on with this is very much part of our culture. And you really hit the nail on the head saying that, and I'm using my own words, but you're looking for something exciting. Like, for example, let me do this. Or let me do a 12-week transformation. Let me sign up to this program. It's like, no. Do the boring shit, excuse my language.
It's a click culture as well. You know, often we buy things on the internet, which are, okay, that will do it. All I've clicked now, I've got that. But actually, all of those things are all you're doing is that's the first step. The first step towards something. And I think we were in a culture now where things are told you that they'll come really, really easy. They don't want to be told that there's going to be graft and this is going to be difficult. My sense is you begin to understand yourself, your strengths, what you really bring to something. You understand your own limitations or blind spots. You work with somebody close to you to help you support what you do. I mean, that's what I've done. I've had somebody I've worked closely with in terms of what I'd have called peer supervision over many, many years. Somebody I trust, somebody I think who wants the best for me, and you know, a confidant, if you like, of when things haven't been going well, that I've been able to say. And also I think that in my role, it's kept me in tune with, I know what it's like to be on the other side of that relationship, of opening up and talking. And again, a lot of people don't really understand that, whether it's mentoring, coaching, psychology, these associated disciplines, it's often just having somebody there that you trust, that you can talk to and make sense of your own inner experience. So when we just think, you know, it's a bit cloudy, it's a bit abstract. And so, for instance, if I were to try to explain to you a difficulty I was having in my life, I've got to organize my thoughts in a way so you understand me. And it's that process actually that helped me understand myself, because I make connections between things in verbalizing it. And also the other part is if I'm talking out loud, I'm hearing myself from a different perspective. So again, a lot of my work is, you know, the people will say, a great listener, or he listened really well, or he didn't seem to do much of the talking.
Yeah.
And again, it's sometimes it's asking the right questions of people and hearing their, what are the context, what's their context they're in. So if they're underperforming, what's going on more widely for them, not just in their sport, but in their life. and sometimes helping them make connections between things that they're maybe a bit blind to. So it's also about continual improvement. So I've been doing this 30 years. I'm still trying to, I'm enthusiastic still about what I do, but I'm still trying to improve what I do. But fundamentally, I know it won't really change that much.
I often say to CEOs, let me give you a good listening to. It was a nice couple of things that have come up, Brian, I'd really like to ask about. One was the individual side, which was really interesting. Something we've been talking and playing with recently in a conversation JP and I had was around opinions of others in performance. And I shared some of my stories from opinions really being, unless they're coming from a reliable source, it's really just white noise. Yeah. I'd love to explore your thoughts on that.
Okay. Well, yeah, probably two ways of looking at it. In sport, you do hear the opinions of others. You know, I can think of an Australian test cricketer I worked, he got to number one in the world at one point, but when he'd had a sort of a in and out early selection in his test career, and he often heard the commentators tearing apart his technique, saying he'd never succeed at test level. So you've got that noise going on, but these are of not people that he wouldn't trust, but people in the industry or in that sport who are deemed to be informed. So you've got opinions which might count against you, and that's quite tough. I think in sport, unlike other walks of life, perhaps in business to some degree, if it's about profit or whatever, but you're in sport, your results are in the public domain. So for instance, if I go to work and I don't do particularly well on a session, no one really knows about it. I might know, that wasn't particularly good. But in sport, your numbers are on the internet. You know, if in your golf you missed a cut, or you might not have qualified for something, or you've got relegated. So those opinions are going to be there. It's one of those things, I guess, in terms of the basics of performances, is where you can't control that. Other people will, that goes with the territory. Others, you don't, it's an opinion. So one thing I'd say to something that I say, let's say, Matt, I say, who's the best golfer in the world at the moment? What would you say?
Probably Rory.
Right, okay. And if I said it's Dustin Johnson, then I'd say, well, are you right or am I right?
Yeah.
Well, you could say, well, it could be world rankings or whatever, but you're basically saying, and so I'm saying, it's just because it's, I have an opinion and it's different from yours, it doesn't mean I'm right and you're wrong. We just have a different opinion. The other thing is, as I say, is often when I talk to people about people's opinions, they'll realize, you have to help them realize actually that, well, I said, well, have you actually read that or heard that? You've seen that somewhere. And their typical answer might be, well, no. And so what you're saying is that thing within human nature, because we're social animals, and it is important to some degree in terms of being a functioning part of society, that we do need to care somewhat about what people think about us, because it is important. But often you say to people, when they say, well, I haven't edited it, I say, well, actually, you've got to work out actually probably that this is your own thought process. It's your own thoughts about yourself, or your fears about yourself, about how you may be perceived, rather than that being real and in the public domain. And that's when you sort of get into the beliefs about hindering beliefs about themselves, which are probably limiting them. Mm. And this, then it goes into kind of, my experience kind of goes into success and failure. It's about their perceptions. People see them quite binary as success or failure. And I've often found the word failure quite damaging to people. It's used in the media a lot. And I work a lot with people, especially young people, on redefining what failure might look like. You know, because if you've gone and you busted a gut and you've given everything you've got and you haven't won, it doesn't mean you're a failure. There could be lots of variables that have affected. You're running a marathon yesterday, JP. If you've got a time that you're really disappointed with, you wouldn't necessarily say I failed. You just say I didn't have a good day. it's not necessarily failure. So the narrative is created, and often the opinions of others is, whether it be parents or people in the media or whatever, I'm very big on, you know, you've got to decide. You've got to decide what your opinion is of yourself. And if that's fairly robust, it can be all right. But always an eye, you know, for instance, I'm conscious of how I might be perceived if I put things out. I want to be known professionally for what I do. I know I put things out, and I know in part of my mind, so-and-so might think, oh, you're this or you're that, or look at you. And I just think, well, actually, well, I'm quite proud of my work. So I'm entitled to put that out there, as to say, this is who I am, this is what I've done. I know there'll be people out there who might think, well, I'm better than him, or he's not very good, or as my dad used to say, probably quite more bluntly, he said, there'll always be people who think Brian Hemmings is this, that, or the other.
I think that's...
But just to finish off what you say, Matt, and then come in, JP, when I work with people, I sort of draw concentric circles around them. So them in the middle, concentric circles. And then I say, like, you know, you said people around you who you trust their opinions, the people who maybe got the same values, who know deeply about what you're doing, how you run your business, how you hold yourself. And I sort of get them to put people in those concentric circles. And then I say, so the opinions, as you get further from that middle circle of yourself, what you're basically saying is you learn to trust less what's going on. Of course, and if they're in the public domain, some people choose not to read papers. Or there was a really good, you might have seen it on the internet. There was an American, I'm not sure if he was basketball or baseball, but the interview said something about a failure this season, you know, about trying to create a narrative. And he stopped it and he said, did you get a promotion this season in your job as a journalist? And he said, no.
Sorry. Yeah. He said, was that a failure?
Are you a failure then?
Yeah.
You know, just because I didn't get a promotion this season, does it mean I'm a failure? And he really nailed him, actually. I thought it was very, very smart.
Yeah, it was a good move.
And you are starting to get some of that back now, in that people are starting to, as I might say, redefine what failure is. I think that's helpful. It's not to say that we can't be disappointed sometimes or not achieve what we want to achieve, but you hinder yourself, you damage yourself if you label yourself as a failure every time you don't get what you want. Mm. JP, sorry, I sort of butted you out there.
No. I was trying to respectfully interrupt because I want to keep asking you more and more questions. Thank you for such deep and thoughtful answers. Whilst we are on attention control and choice, I would love to, thinking of our audience, our listeners, our students, our clients, talk about thriving under pressure and just get you to share your thoughts on why skill isn't enough and some helpful ways in which people can overcome pressure. So if we move from sports psychology to performance psychology in business, let's say we have two people. We got John and Jill. They're both overworked, underslept, super busy. And the self-talk is just that exactly. I'm super busy, I'm super tired, I'm super stressed, over and over and over again. And of course, they can't bring themselves into a better level of performance because they keep saying how stressed and overworked they are. What are some tips that you would share for people that, and this is probably going to be most people that we work with, are at times feeling like my life is just on top of me? Because I believe too, respectfully to everyone, that it's choice. What you choose to do in that moment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, that's pretty fair. I mean, you talked about self-determination earlier, and that's about choice, about autonomy, relational aspects of it. So yeah, central to that is choice. I'd say firstly is at some point you've got to stop and take stock of if I'm unhappy with my existence and perhaps my health suffering, my performance isn't getting better, is I need to do some sort of reevaluation of here of what's happening. Some useful tips. I would talk when I work with people, JP, I often talk about the concept of zooming in and zooming out. So zooming in would be in what situations where they feel under pressure, you know, maybe where there's physiological changes and they sense psychologically that they're struggling, is what skills can you equip people with in that moment? So that might be something like breathing, in terms of if it's something like arousal control, some breathing techniques. Sometimes in sport, it might be imagery techniques, it might be routines, something that helps them initially cope better. Because I think if you think you're jumping from not coping under pressure to thriving under pressure, thriving would you suggest is more is I'm actually really enjoying this. Thriving is about mastery, but actually I think is to some extent is actually in enjoying that experience, irrespective of what the result is. Recognizing that I might not always win. But that's what I would think is thriving is a positive experience, not just performing under pressure. Thriving under pressure is different. And then I would say the concept of zooming out is, so for example, what is it about that situation that makes them feel pressure? Because the school of psychology is cognitive psychology, is, well, objectively a situation is a situation. It's the beliefs and attitudes I bring to that which drives my perception of, is this pressure or is just something I deal with. So for example, let's say when I was much younger, and if I was lecturing to 300 people at first, that would be a terrifying experience. But you learn skills, you gain experience, you get to know your subject better. So now if I were going to that room, I'm not suggesting it would be a breeze, but and there might be some physiological arousal because that's a performance to me. But I would, the very thought of it wouldn't make me feel pressured. It's an objective situation. So firstly, when you're working with people, is one situation is pressure to one, the same situation isn't pressure to another. So you've got to help them understand what is it about that situation that makes them feel under pressure. So if you zoom out, then what you might be changing is beliefs or attitudes about that situation to maybe reframe it so they see it in a different way. So in other words, if I can see the situation in a different way, necessarily I might feel less pressure in it from the start. But for example, life being life, is that we do get physiologically aroused, we do maybe get a bit nervous, or we do start to focus on the outcome to some degree. And remember, some of that is healthy too. If we're in a competitive situation, it's you might, well, say take the edge off it, but you expect it to be a bit of cut and thrust, and
exactly.
And you'd want some level of arousal to it. You know, sometimes I've worked with people in business and it's addressing a business meeting and it's their turn to talk and they can feel their heart rate rising as they're going to have to explain, or it's going to be a difficult meeting, or the board is there and it could potentially be quite hostile. You know, what's someone's performance context? What is it about that they feel pressured? Because once they start to realize what it specifically is that makes it a potential experience where they're not maybe performing as well as they can, and they understand themselves, then they can start to address it. So zooming out is looking at the beliefs and attitudes about what is it that makes me feel pressured in a negative sense. How can I start to reframe that I might start to see that? And you might have read some of the literature about threat and challenge. You know, if you perceive it to be a threatening situation, then the physiological response and your psychological response will be probably not that facilitative to you. If you can start to see that situation as a challenge by reframing it, the physiological response will be greater. In sport, obviously, that's really important. But I think even in business, it's about your performance is likely to be better. You're likely to thrive. And I say to people in sport that just because you see it as a challenge, it doesn't mean you're going to succeed. You probably just give yourself a better chance of being in a frame of mind to see things in more of a positive, facilitative way. So this is a challenge. I've got the skills to meet that challenge. So hey ho, let's get in there and have a go. But I still believe that some people then, well, you know, look, if you've got a 3-foot putt to win a major championship, you might still need some self-regulation skills in that moment to help you manage that, because it won't be a walk in the park.
I use threat challenge appraisal when I'm speaking to big audiences about to get into the boxing ring, and I will turn anxiety into enthusiasm just by attention control, managing my thoughts, my breath, etc. But absolutely, I totally agree with what you said. Sorry, Dr. Hemmings. I totally agree with what you said. If it keeps showing up over and over again, it's really time to reevaluate your life.
Yeah, and so that's when you get into sort of, well, you both talked about values earlier, and about the importance of values is what the important values in my life. What am I moving towards those values, or am I moving away? What are the things that move me towards it? What are the things that move me away from it? So it could be values, or it could be, you know, do I need to learn some self-regulation skills? Do I need to upskill myself in some way for the role I've got or the tasks I've got? And that's where you individualize it, isn't it? Is it values? Is it attitudes? Is it skills? That's the richness of my work and your work.
Brian, I've got one, maybe a finale question. I hope it's not too big a one, but something I've been playing with lately and talking about within the mastermind and with JP, Mark, Clive and our team is the theory of playing to win, not playing not to lose. And you don't give yourself an option to win if you give yourself an option to lose. I'd love your take on that, your spin.
That sounds like and maybe your listeners won't, unless they're golfers, like Bobrachella.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. It's playing not to lose is, you know, that sense of caution. And I often talk to people about, you know, kind of what's your style? You know, how what's your best strategy? How do you get the best out of yourself? And I've worked, you know, worked with lots of, we're talking about golf here particularly, but the best ones are always looking up. Is how can I get the next place up, not how can I avoid the next place down. And I think that's that sort of playing to win. And I often say, look, you know, if you're not going to win, do it in a way that you're happy with. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, you're the one who has to live with yourself. If you go and play not to lose, often that's when people feel really, really dejected and almost catastrophic, because they've not even gone out to play how they want to play.
And applies to every area of life.
Yeah, and it's not, there's no enjoyment in that either. It's, you know, if you practice and you live your life in a certain way to get the best out of yourself, then when it really comes down to it, why would you not do that when you really need to? When the time comes to try and put that performance in, is you've got to go and approach it in the way that you approach how you've approached preparing for it in your life. Why would you try and do something different at the end? It's like, well, I haven't practiced that. I haven't practiced playing not to lose.
I practice to win. Even the expression on your face, Brian, it's the thought I have inside me is, why are you even showing up?
I understand you, once you work with people and you understand what drives them and what their fears are, then you, of course, you begin to understand why they might do that. Most people, it's a journey of understanding themselves better. And sometimes that takes time. I think again the narrative is often everybody can do this kind of straight away, and you know, you mentioned earlier about comparisons and opinions, that human beings do compare themselves against others quite unfavorably. I remember working with one guy, he was a major winner, and this was when he was early days as a pro, and I'd worked with him with England, and I was sitting down and he was sort of bemoaning his first year on tour, where so-and-so was performing better than him and so-and-so was performing better than him. And I remember stopping him and saying, this is just selective bias. You know, you're just choosing people that are doing better than you to, you know, you ain't doing yourself any favors here. I said, you're not comparing yourself with the people who you are outperforming. And then the next year we were sitting down, and one of the people he compared himself with against the previous year was doing worse than him. And I said to him, yeah, you're not effing bloody comparing yourself with him now, are you? You're somebody else to compare, you know. So look, people are competitive. You'll always get that level of some degree of comparison. I think it's inevitable, but it's not doing it in such a way where it really consumes you. You know, there'll always be people doing things, and they'll have a good run, and they'll do. But and then people try and copy. And just, you know, just do work out yourself what's your method, and stick to it. And it will bring, and it will, more often than not, you'll get your rewards. And if you've got things that you find difficult to stick to, then talk to people about it and find out ways of sticking to it. And you know, sport, there's you know, unfortunately not everybody gets to the top. That's the nature of it.
Doesn't mean you've been a failure.
No, it doesn't. And I really mean that with young people. Yeah. I've said that, is that, you know, look, if you don't get it, don't. And I look them in the eye and say, no, you know, I haven't got a crystal ball about how you're going to do, but whatever happens, you will not be a failure. You won't be a failure. And that's important for people to, you know, they might not achieve everything they want to, but it doesn't mean that they have to brandish themselves in that way.
One final question, Brian, if I may as well, and I've not teed you up for this, to use our golfing analogies, but what, something we're very big on is building the inner muscles. What do the words spiritual fitness mean to you?
Spiritual fitness. Okay. Well, spiritual to me would I'd kind of take that literally, first of all, in terms of, are they a spiritual person? What, you know, I've worked with some athletes, for example, who are spiritual or religious, and that, you know, you try and understand where that fits into their life, if it's a part of their culture. You know, if you work with, I'm based in London. If you work with some Eastern European athletes or South American, if you talk about Christianity or African, that it's much more part of their being, their everyday being. It's a faith and belief really drives them. So you have to, even if I didn't necessarily have a spiritual belief, I try and understand that for them, in terms of how it drives their life and drives their values and choices and so on. So spiritual fitness, I'm not sure. My immediate, I could probably waffle an answer to you, but I can't necessarily, don't think it would be that useful. But I would say, if spiritual is important to you, the spiritual aspect of life, then look at what that says to you about how you should live your life on a daily basis. And is that consistent? I was thinking about more of about when you were starting to ask the question, and forgive me if this is a misperception, but I was thinking more about spiritual stroke mental fitness. Or what are the things that you can do every day to put yourself in that frame? And I would say, well, some of the things I've talked about are discipline and recognizing that actually they might not be sexy, but those things that you do repetitively, almost ritually, if you like, in the short term, it might not seem to be that they're that important, but you get to realize over time that they're the things that will really sustain me, and the things that are likely to bring me the sort of life I want, both, I guess, professionally and personally. You know, listen, I've had times in my life where I've been deeply unhappy, but I've still been professionally successful because I've kept doing those things. But there's no doubt that when I'm at my best professionally, it's when I'm also personally happy.
I think that is a genius place to finish. In the essence, JP, is there anything else that you'd like to share just before we close this beautiful?
Yeah, I just, once again, I love how you really go really deep into understanding the question before answering it. It reminds me of Albert Einstein. When given a problem, and now it's solve a problem, I'll spend the first 55 minutes understanding the problem. I just thought it was a really great answer. Even if you kind of went in one way and another way, in short, I'd probably say, you know, having faith and discipline and the awareness that not all things are sexy.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian. And I'll continue to speak with you offline as well. So I've put an invite out there to join us in the mastermind at some time. But I know you're busy these next few months, but we'll definitely keep in touch. I would say that's a great place to call it a wrap for the Live Your Full Potential podcast for today. Dr. Brian Hemmings, thank you so much for joining us. JP in Thailand, looking beautiful weather out there. And thank you so much.
Super grateful. I would love to do a round two. Thank you, Dr. Brian Hemmings. That was amazing.
Well, lovely to meet you, JP, and you as well, Matt. Thanks for facilitating that. Have a good day, guys.
All right. Thank you so much.
Take care.